Welcome to Debrief. I'm Megan Murphy, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. With each episode, we'll sit down with the world's leading business leaders, entrepreneurs, and political figures. It's a peek behind the scenes of global business, culture, and politics, a firsthand conversation with the people who are shaping the world's economy. If you don't feel smarter afterward, then we aren't doing our job. When I spoke with President Obama in June 2016, along with a group of Bloomberg editors, the world looked very different. The UK was poised for a referendum on whether to remain in the EU, a vote that all the smart money said would be yes. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were slogging it out in the polls, and for many people, a Clinton victory seemed all but guaranteed. And we all know how that turned out. In a rare Oval Office interview, the president spoke candidly about free trade, why his daughters won't work on Wall Street, and what he'd do if he were a CEO.
All right, let's talk to the economy.
Successful economy, stock markets up 3 times, profits are very high, and yet you still often have this label of being a kind of anti-business figure. How do you look at that?
Well, first of all, towards the end of my second term, I think among the business community, there's maybe a greater acknowledgement, a less grudging acknowledgement that we steered through the worst financial and economic crisis in our lifetimes successfully, certainly more successfully than many of our peers. We're now 10% above the GDP pre-crisis. In Europe, for example, they're just now getting to back to even. As you mentioned, the stock market obviously has come roaring back, but I think more relevant for ordinary folks, we've cut the unemployment rate in half. We have been able to have the longest consecutive months of job growth, private sector job growth, in our history. Biggest job growth since the 90s in manufacturing. The auto industry's come roaring back and is selling more cars than ever. We've doubled the production of clean energy. Our production of traditional fossil fuels has exceeded all expectations. So we've been able to grow the economy, reduce unemployment, and cut the deficit by around 3/4. So it's hard to argue with the facts. I think where the business community has traditionally voiced complaints about my administration is in the regulatory sector. And yet, if you look at the results, Dodd-Frank being a good example, it is indisputable that our banking system and our financial sector is safer and more stable than it was when I came into office. Now, what's also true is that banking profits are not as outsized as they were, but I don't consider that a bad thing, and I think most Americans don't either. They're still making a profit, it's just that there is a froth that has been eliminated, and that is good over the long term for the financial sector. When it comes to energy, we take climate change seriously. Obviously, for extractive industries like oil or coal, that means they are less freewheeling than they might otherwise be, and our shift towards a clean energy future is something that they may see as a threat. My argument to them would be, view it as an opportunity. And there's no reason why a lot of big oil companies and gas companies and coal companies can't think about how do they transition and get in the game when it comes to wind power or solar power. So there will continue to be, I think, some pushback on regulation. If you look at our track record, we have actually applied cost-benefit analysis, which used to be considered a very conservative thing, to every regulation we've issued. It is indisputable and in measurable ways that The benefits of our regulations have far exceeded the costs. So overall, after some bumps along the way, our relationship with the business community, I think, is healthy. You know, we don't do everything they want us to do, and there are points of tension in every industry, but there are also areas of great cooperation. Nowhere is that more apparent than in the innovation economy, where our work with the tech community, with the biotech industry, around things like precision medicine or smart cars or UAS's, drones, or the patent system, all indicate the degree to which, by working together, we're putting America on a more competitive footing.
Can I ask you one specific question on the problem on Wall Street there? Do you think it's a benefit of regulation that it did reduce profitability in the industry as opposed to just making the system safer? In other words, that big banks aren't making as much profit as they were. They're unlikely to just because the model itself has been squeezed. Is that something that you view as a good side effect of that regulation?
Our intention has not been to reduce profits just for the sake of reducing profits. Our intention has been to reduce reckless behavior that led to outsized profits. So I think the fact that it is harder to leverage and trade in ways that threaten the stability of the economy as a whole is a positive for the U.S. economy. It may show up in terms of less profitability for some banking activities, but my argument has always been start making money the old-fashioned way. Don't gamble. Invest.
Do you think there was a thing where we had the other day I interviewed Jamie Dimon. Jamie Dimon came out with a statement saying, I don't think in the next 10 years you're going to see a banker serving in a senior role in Washington. Do you think, is that part of the same thing? Do you think that's unlikely as well?
There's no doubt that the banking industry took a hit post-Lehman. What was interesting is early in my administration, somehow they often thought that me or Tim Geithner or others were fanning the flames of anti-bank sentiment. And we'd have to explain to them, no, what's fanning the flames is the fact that people have lost their homes and their savings, and this is all spilled out into Main Street while you guys are still made out all right. And hopefully there's been some more reflection on the part of the banking industry. There are a number of bank CEOs, including somebody like a Jamie Dimon, who I think are smart and are outstanding business people, but they have different roles to play. Their job is to serve their shareholders, maximize profits, run a business. My job as President of the United States is to make sure that the overall system is stable and that the economy as a whole is well served by a healthy, functioning system that allocates capital in efficient ways. And that means that the interests of any individual bank or banker are not always going to be congruent with the interests of the economy as a whole. That shouldn't be a surprise. I would say that the American people should be suspicious if anybody who's occupying this office thinks that whatever is good for the top 10 banks is automatically good for America. And even bankers shouldn't want their president to be thinking that way. When we put together, for example, a Consumer Finance Protection Board, which has been deeply opposed by Republicans, and they're still trying to roll it back. The basic view that anything should go ignores the evidence that of the role that predatory lending played in the crisis back in 2007-2008. And when we put forward regulations that make mortgages simpler and more intelligible to consumers, that may be bad for somebody's short-term bottom line if their business model is built on pushing out shaky loans to consumers, but it will actually be good for the housing market and for the financial system as a whole if people know what they're buying and they can afford the mortgages they take on.
But some of the rules put in place have meant that it's harder to get loans. I think something like 58% of approved mortgages are going to the wealthiest applicants, and home ownership among African Americans is down. So where's the balance there?
Well, the interesting thing, because we look at this very carefully, is that there's no doubt that there has been some pullback and increased conservatism on the part of lenders. But oftentimes it's not justified by the regulations. Mm-hmm. It is a byproduct of them rethinking their business model. So if you talk to a number of bankers, what they'll say is, look, these loans, if structured in a way that people can actually afford what they're buying, aren't that profitable to us. Or small business loans may just not be worth us churning through the paperwork. That is independent of any regulatory requirements that are being placed on them. And typically what you've seen is a pendulum swinging, where after a financial crisis, oftentimes there's a pullback on the part of the banking industry. My suspicion is that will end up loosening. Mm-hmm. And when it does, that's when you want to make sure that those regulations are avoiding some of the excesses that we saw in the past.
It's interesting, though. You don't seem, it strikes me, you're unlikely in your afterlife to end up working on Wall Street. Would you be happy if your daughters ended up on Wall Street?
Well, I'm pretty certain that my daughters will not end up working on Wall Street. I genuinely believe that one of the great comparative advantages that we have as a country is this extremely broad, deep, sophisticated financial sector. Mm-hmm. It means that there's more capital flowing through this country that can be directed to startups and small businesses and expansion than any place else. And we want to keep it that way. But I do believe, and this is not just my bias, I think a lot of economists share this view, that if you start getting to the point where 40% of the economy is taken up by the financial sector, and that our best and brightest are going into financial work as opposed to engineering or computer science, then we could actually lose our competitive edge over time. And we don't have a command and control economy. Ultimately, the market will figure out what that looks like. But what we don't want to do is to set up the rules in such a way where we are skewing the decision-making of both the next generation of talent or businesses towards financial manipulation as a means of building wealth, as opposed to making stuff and inventing stuff and coming up with goods and services that people actually use.
Talking about that, when we look at, we've talked about some of the positive things in the economy, unemployment rate, but we still see productivity a big problem. We have growth sort of hovering around 2%.
Right.
People like Larry Summers talk about secular stagnation.
Right.
When you look at how to stimulate growth and also to prepare our economy for what we have going forward and how much it's changed, what do you think are avenues of growth?
Well,
do you think something fundamentally underneath this has changed, that there isn't the same kind of growth that was possible when you came in, perhaps now isn't?
Well, I'm a congenital optimist about the prospects of the American economy and the world economy generally. If our expectations are to duplicate the growth here in the United States that occurred right after World War II, when Europe was destroyed, Japan was destroyed, half of Europe was behind an iron curtain, and billions of people in China and India were suffering under either communist rule in the case of China or socialist approaches to the economy that stifled creativity and growth and innovation in India, then we have to see that as a unique period in our history. But I do believe that we can grow a lot faster than we're growing right now. And I think we can grow faster than any other advanced economy. Some of this foundation that we've laid out I think puts us in a position to do that. The investments we've made in R&D, the investments that we're making in clean energy, the investment we've been making in education and job training, those are all things that may not have a payoff today, but will have a payoff 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. So just to take a simple example, when I came into office, we started working both with the public sector but also the private sector, companies like Intel, to say, how are we going to produce more engineers? And our goal has been to generate 100,000 more engineers, but also engineering teachers and really focus on STEM education. That will help with productivity growth over the long term, even though it may not show up in year one, year two, year three of that initiative. The things that we have not done that we need to do that could make an enormous difference are proposals that I put forward that Congress has so far blocked. The most obvious one would be infrastructure. We have about $2 trillion worth of deferred maintenance. And those are jobs that can't be shipped overseas. Those are jobs that not only economists will tell you create a multiplier effect throughout the economy, but also lay the foundation for long-term productivity. And at a time when capital is so cheap, for us not to be doing that is crazy. And historically, infrastructure investment has been bipartisan. Eisenhower built the interstate railway system. Our first president, Abraham Lincoln, was pretty big on locks and dams and roads.
We need a president who's in the real estate industry.
Well,
there's one up running now.
That I'm not sure about. But there's no doubt that that's something we should be doing that would generate higher growth and would generate productivity gains right now. The fact that we haven't fixed our immigration system in an intelligent way is contrary to what our experience tells us, which is that compared to Europe or China or Japan, one of our biggest advantages is attracting continually new talent, strivers who want to come to this country, who are willing to take enormous risks to get here, and then are going to try to start a new business or populate entire communities that have fallen on hard times, that will make a significant difference. The making college more affordable so that every young person is getting some post-high school training. If our workers are better trained, have higher skills, that's going to make us more productive. So there are a number of things that we could do right now that don't require some out-of-the-box policy initiatives that would really make a difference in boosting productivity growth. I also believe that increasing wages as a share of the overall economy will help us grow. Now,
what do you think is the ideal minimum wage? Well, you've said 12 before, but how high can it go?
Here's what I would say as a general proposition, that if you work full-time in our society, you should be above the poverty rate. And that might mean something different in Manhattan than it does in a small town in Arkansas or Oklahoma. But what is absolutely clear is there's a certain threshold above which you can pay your bills and below which you can't. Now, what our economic history seems to indicate is that when workers have a sufficient share of the overall pie, they spend it. Consumer confidence grows, and businesses are more prone to invest. One of the problems that we have right now, and I talk to CEOs who tell me, look, if we're growing at 2%, then I don't need to make significant business investment to make a profit. I just have to make sure that through automation and other means, I'm keeping my costs low enough that I'm going to make money selling basically the same amount of stuff. If you have workers making a better wage, now you got bigger markets to go chase. And what we also know is that the attitudes of people when they see some modest increase in their wages ends up having a virtuous effect on the economy as a whole. So I think that as we move towards a economy where because of automation, you need fewer and fewer people to make more and more stuff. More and more of us are going to have to move into the service sector. The service sector historically has been a low-wage sector. And in order for us to make sure that we don't see this growing divide between haves and have-nots, with a middle class that is shrinking, we're going to have to make sure that the service sector pays better. Think about how difficult it is right now for a young, idealistic person who wants to go into teaching to figure out how they're going to live a middle-class life as a teacher. Now, there's no job that's more important to our economy than having really good teachers in the classroom, but right now, the way our economy is structured, it's very hard for young people to make that decision unless their parents are subsidizing them in a fairly significant way.
And so what's the answer to that problem?
Well, that's an example of us thinking about how do we pay our teachers, how do we pay our healthcare workers. More and more people are going to be going into that sector. Those are sectors, by the way, where productivity gains are not going to be as fast because, by definition, interacting with a child or helping an elderly person who is going through physical therapy is less tied to, less subject to automation. And so we're going to have to make some broader decisions in terms of the social compact about how folks who are making a living in really important, necessary jobs are getting compensated. My broader point, though, is that for a while, I think there's been a tendency among economists, business leaders, pundits, to pose this conflict between issues of equity and distribution and efficiency. And my argument is that we should be investing in those things that are going to make us more efficient, like infrastructure, like R&D, like education, like trade, which puts me in conflict sometimes with some of my members. I'm not somebody who believes, or some the members of my party, I'm not somebody who believes that we can lop off the global supply chain and somehow that's going to make us more productive, even if it was possible. But I also believe that if you combine those things that make us more efficient and more productive with a strategy to increase wages and incomes for those folks who are increasingly going to be employed in the service sectors, then you will not only get sustained broader economic growth, but you'll also gain the political consensus that's necessary to continue becoming more efficient over time.
Just try to argue with that. You look at, we're in the middle of this transition, arguably as big as what happened from the agricultural to the industrial revolution 150 years ago. That took like sort of 30 or so years to go through. This time around, actually, I mean, quite a lot of economists would say this time globalization is really going to start targeting all those services jobs. And if you want to keep up wages in that area, doesn't it in the end push us as a society, not in your presidency, but in some time in the future, towards some kind of thing like a universal basic income or some kind of...
The way I describe it is that because of automation, because of globalization, we are going to have to examine the social compact the same way we did early in the 19th century and then again during and after the Great Depression. So you know, the notion of a 40-hour work week, a minimum wage, child labor laws, et cetera, those will have to be updated.
We might have to work less. We might have to...
For these new realities. But if we are smart right now, then we build ourselves a runway to make that transition that is less abrupt because we're still growing and we're beating the competition around the world. And so with more surplus, with more wealth, with a better performing economy, those choices don't look as wrenching. If we don't make good decisions now, and growth is slow, and people feel as if they're losing ground, then it becomes harder to have those discussions. So you're absolutely right, John, that you know, if, for example, smart cars, where the technology basically exists now, start moving out across our economy, the number of people who are currently employed driving vehicles of some sort is enormous, and some of those jobs are pretty good jobs. You know, people are worried about Uber, but the fear is actually driverless Uber, right? Or driverless buses, or what have you. Now, there are all kinds of reasons why society may be better off if smart cars are the norm. Significant drops in traffic fatalities, much more efficient use of the vehicle so that we're less likely to emit as much pollution and carbon that causes climate change. You know, drastically reduce traffic, which means that we're giving back hours to families that are currently taken up in road rage. all kinds of reasons why we may want to do that. But if we haven't given any thought to where are the people who are currently making a living driving are transferring into, then there's going to be deep resistance. So trying to separate out issues of efficiency and productivity from issues of distribution and how people experience their own lives and their ability to take care of their families, I think is a bad recipe. I think it's not an either-or situation, it's a both-and situation.
But one of the reasons people are feeling left behind in the climate we have now is because of free trade. Mm-hmm. Have we not done a good job of selling the benefits of trade to people who feel that this is something that's taking their jobs, taking away their future? A couple
of interesting things about trade, and obviously I've been giving this a lot of thought because we invested a lot of time and effort and energy around the Trans-Pacific Partnership and are now in the process of negotiating with Europe on the transatlantic deal as well. Number one, the majority of Americans, surveys show, still favor free trade. It's just that those who are opposed feel it much more intensely. Number two, there is no doubt that some of the trade deals of the past and the way in which globalization occurred over the course of the last 40 years has not always been to the U.S. advantage. So you take the example of China's ascension to WTO. From a geopolitical perspective, it was absolutely the right thing to do. And since I have friends who were there when that happened and are now, in our administration or advising the Clinton campaign or others, I've talked to them. And in fairness, nobody anticipated that China suddenly was going to be the engine of world manufacturing that rapidly. But there probably were some safeguards that could have been built to make sure that they weren't devaluing their currency unfairly, that they weren't engaged in the same the kind of state-owned enterprise subsidies and dumping that they were. And hopefully we have learned lessons from what happened there. My argument for my friends in the union movement, for example, and I'm a strong union supporter and believe that we should have laws here in this country that make it easier, not harder, to give workers a voice. My argument to them is if you're fighting that battle, you're fighting the last war. That you have to recognize that globalization is here to stay. That to keep one of the auto plants that have reopened and grown here in the United States operating at full capacity, they're reliant on parts from all over the world, and trying to disentangle that is all but impossible. And our goal then should be to try to shape trade deals that raise standards everywhere. And that's what we've done with TPP. I just came back from Vietnam. They are introducing measures in their constitution to recognize worker organizations that are independent from the government for the first time. The only reason they are doing that is because they wanted to be part of TPP and wanted to be part of this massive regional market. And the same is true for environmental standards. We're able to have conversations with Malaysia about not just human trafficking, but wildlife trafficking, because they are interested in TPP. So the goal when it comes to trade is to learn from where globalization has fallen short in the past and to try to embed in the trade agreements higher standards across the board so that we have a level playing field. If we simply pretend that trade will go away or that we can block it off, then China will set the rules for trade for the next 20, 30, 50 years, It sure won't be good for U.S. businesses. It won't be good for U.S. workers. And ultimately, it won't be as good for workers in Vietnam or the people of Malaysia or other countries that we're working with. Now, the last point I'd make on this is the challenge from a perceptions point of view is that the benefits of globalization we take for granted. The costs are highly visible. You can argue that one of the reasons that inflation has been so low over the last two decades is because we're able to get a lot of stuff cheap from all around the world. And we take for granted that we can get a flat screen TV really cheap, or that we get clothes that fit better and last longer than when I was a kid. You know, you walk into the J. Crew or the Gap, and it's a great improvement. I try to tell my kids, you know, you guys look a lot sharper than I did when I was your age, because we went to Sears and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't working the same way. On the other hand, when a plant closes, we see it, and people feel it acutely, and entire communities feel it acutely. So I think this is where the need for us to go into those localized areas that are most acutely affected by trade and work with them, not to sell them a bill of goods that somehow, if we just stop trade, all those manufacturing jobs are coming back, because they're not. Automation has displaced them a lot more than globalization has. It does require us to go into those communities and say, we're gonna make sure that your kid is getting the kind of training that allows them to succeed in the next generation of manufacturing, the next generation of biotech. We're going to make sure that your entire community has broadband. And one of the great successes of our administration that hasn't been talked about a lot is the fact that, you know, in part because of some smart decisions we made about spectrum and laying broadband lines, the penetration and the speed of broadband in this country since I came into office has grown exponentially. Through a program called Connected, we've got 98, we're on track for 98.99% of schools around America to be connected with high-speed broadband in their classrooms. So we've got to go in those communities and say, here's how we're going to do it. That's part of what our manufacturing hubs have been all about. Finding communities that have been hard hit and saying, we can still make stuff, but you know, if your strategy is just to make the same old steel that you were making 30 years ago, you're not going to be able to outsell the Chinese or the Brazilians or others. But what we can do is have an old Kodak plant suddenly be at the cutting edge of photonics and train an entire generation through your community colleges and universities so that they are expert in that field, and you will see a new growth that is compatible with globalization and will allow you to succeed. I'll give you 5 minutes.
Okay, good.
I'll give you 5 minutes.
Can I just come back at you on that? I mean, what you've described very accurately is how progressive politics should deal with globalization. Right. I interviewed Tony Blair last week. Exactly the same thing, but for progressive politics, particularly on the centre-left, centre-right, the basic fact seems to be out there that people aren't getting it. They're not. People are revolting against globalisation, not just to do with Donald Trump, Brexit, right. Marine Le Pen, all these different bits. They don't accept the stuff about immigration.
Right.
They don't like the picture to do with free trade.
Right.
They don't like the idea of elites making money out of the globalised economy. All those things go together. Do you have the rules of the politics of selling that message, have they changed?
My argument has been that the reason people are resistant to that argument is because global elites have been inattentive to the issues of wages, incomes, and opportunity for ordinary people. If you are selling globalization and saying it's great, even though each year, not just in the United States, but across the advanced economy, you're seeing more and more of a winner-take-all economy, where not just the top 1%, but the top 0.01% are getting a larger and larger share, then yeah, it's going to be pretty hard to make the argument that, don't worry, this is great for you. And this is another area where sometimes I find myself arguing with my friends in the business community. The issue is not resentment or class warfare or that somehow we want to level everybody down rather than lift everybody up. The issue is that if, in fact, automation and globalization do have a tendency to create vast wealth and opportunity for a very small, highly skilled set of people, and have a tendency to create a larger and larger group of folks who feel redundant in the economy, and you don't pay attention to that, then people will rightly resist. They will understandably say, I am not getting a good deal.
Is that what Donald Trump is tapping into? Are you surprised by his rise then? Is that exactly the phenomenon?
No, I think that the temptation in that circumstance is to resort to nativism and nostalgia and the sense that these are things that are now out of control and I want to take control back. And that can be true on the left, it can be true on the right, but I continue to believe that the majority of people, whether in the United States, in Europe, or certainly in rapidly advancing parts of the world like Asia, those folks recognize that the world has shrunk and that if the rules are structured properly, that this gives them more opportunity, not less, to succeed. I think people still understand that. If you talk to the younger generation here in the United States, they're not knee-jerk anti-trade. They're not anti-globalization. If you look at surveys, it tends to be older workers who are feeling displaced, who are attracted to this notion of let's pull up the drawbridge and shut everybody off. But if we are to succeed in shaping a sustainable, growing, prosperous, integrated world economy, then we have to pay attention to the trends that push towards greater inequality and find ways to modify those tendencies. And we know how to do it. We know that if we're investing in education, early childhood education, college, making that cheaper and more affordable, then workers are going to have more opportunity. We know that if we have higher minimum wages, then they will get a larger share of the fruits of all these amazing new innovations and globalization. We know that if we have stronger labor standards and workers have more of a voice, that is going to make a difference. And, you know, there were a bunch of decisions that were made back in the 30s by FDR And then again later in this country, in the 60s, that were fiercely resisted by business, but essentially created a social compact and a social welfare state where people said, okay, I'm seeing the benefits of innovation. I'm seeing the benefits of capitalism. I'm seeing the benefits of trade. We just have to update those for the 21st century in the same way that in previous eras we updated those for the shift from agriculture to industry or the shift to a global economy. And that is going to require some farsightedness, not just in the public arena, but also in the private sector. If I'm a CEO in a boardroom right now, I should be thinking about how do I make sure my workers are making a decent wage? And if I'm a shareholder, that is something that I should be paying attention to. Because if you're not, that's when you start getting the kinds of political pushback that you're seeing here in the United States. That's how you start getting a Brexit campaign. And over time, you will strangle this goose that's been laying you all these golden eggs. Share the eggs.
Do you have any desire to run a company yourself? Would you be interested in that?
I've said this before, and I think it surprised a lot of people. If I think about what would stir my passions, had I not gone into politics, it would probably be starting some kind of business. The skill set of starting my presidential campaigns and building the kinds of teams that we did, and marketing ideas, I think would be the same kinds of skills that I would enjoy exercising in the private sector. Now, I'm always careful about drawing too many easy parallels there, because sometimes there are CEOs who come in and start explaining to me how I should be running the presidency, and I sometimes have to stop them and say, all right, one, I appreciate your advice, but imagine a situation in which half your board and management were actively trying to get rid of you and prevent you from accomplishing anything, and you had 2 million employees, and you couldn't fire a large portion of them, and your competitors weren't simply promoting their own products, but were continually saying how your products were the worst that were ever invented and will cause a civilizational crisis. And if you kind of pull that all together, then you got about half of what I'm dealing with on a daily basis.
Which industries would you think about getting into?
Well, it's hard to say. But what I will say is that, just to bring things full circle about innovation, the conversations I have with Silicon Valley, with venture capital, pull together my interest in science and organization in a way that that I find really satisfying. You think about something like precision medicine, the work that we've we've done to try to build off of the breakthroughs in the human genome. The fact that now you can have your personal genome mapped for $1,000 instead of $100,000. The potential for us to identify what your tendencies are and to sculpt medicines that are uniquely effective for you, that's just an example of something I can sit and listen and talk to folks for hours about. And I think the same is true for all kinds of sectors of the economy. Michelle was doing work on Let's Move and healthy eating. And you're seeing now entire industries shaping around how do you get people to eat better in ways that taste great and are much more environmentally conscious. And so a lot of the policy work we've been doing, when you talk to the innovators in these spaces, there's an enormous optimism and an attitude of problem solving, a willingness to experiment and think in new ways that I think is really exciting. We're going to have a global entrepreneurship summit, the last one of a series that we began when I first came into office. And the enthusiasm from around the world about these summits speaks to the advantage that we continue to have here in the United States. It is one of the most effective means of public diplomacy. It's the thing that young people in Africa or in Asia or in Latin America get excited about when they think about America, is this notion that you get a good idea and you organize some people to support you and you learn from your mistakes and you create something entirely new.
You can become Bill Gates.
And you can become Bill Gates, or in some cases, you can electrify a village. And you can save water in a desert and make people a little bit of money, and over time you can see a complete transformation. That's the thing about the U.S. economy that continues to be unique. And it's tied to capitalism and markets, but it's also tied to a faith in science and reason and a mindset that says there's always something new to discover and we don't know everything and we're going to try new things and we're pragmatic. And if we ever lose that, then we will have lost what has made us an incredible force for good in the world. If we sustain it, then we can maintain the kind of progress that has been made. And I always tell interns and young people who I talk to that as tough as things seem right now, do not believe people when they tell you they wish they could go back to the good old days. Because the good old days aren't. I'm now old enough where I remember some of those good old days.
We all are.
But doesn't it annoy you then that the most successful businessman in America, at least by his own reckoning, is Donald Trump?
There's no successful businessman in America who actually thinks the most successful businessman in the country is Donald Trump. I know those guys, and so do you, and I guarantee you that's not their view. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Debrief. I'm Megan Murphy. You can find me on Twitter at Megan Merp. Business Week is on Twitter at BW. And Debrief is available on iTunes, the brand new Bloomberg app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time.